This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening to those of you who are in other continents and time zones. It is the 14th of November already. And this is TGIF DTRA coming to you live or on your favorite podcast platform, Apple, Spotify, Google. And today we're going to talk a lot about participation in trials, patient experience, and how we are learning about modern patient experiences and what we should do to really address some of the things that patients are reporting. Amir, good morning. Well, I'm in the afternoon. You're in the morning. How are things for you?
It's great in California. Things are great. Happy to have Alex and Stacy with us. Where are you guys based? Can you tell us and introduce yourselves?
Stacy? I'll go first. Yeah, so I'm based in the UK. I'm in South Oxfordshire in the UK currently. And I'm head of content and strategy at Curtsy & Curtsy, a patient engagement agency based in Cambridge in the UK.
And I'm Alex Sharp. Oh, sorry, mate.
I was going to say, so you live in Oxford, but the company's in Cambridge.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of university towns going on in that one sentence.
Have they even built that train that was supposed to go between Oxford and Cambridge? Was that never happening?
No. It's still very, very early days. And it's got a lot of red tape to go through yet, I imagine.
Okay, great. Sorry, Alex. I just was...
No, I just think you, Stacey, you represent two of the Golden Triangle in the UK. Very pertinent thing to this conversation. So Alex Charge, I'm the CEO of ISPEP, which is the International Society for Patient Engagement Professionals. It's a not-for-profit organization that we set up, founded last year, and it's grown exponentially internationally. We've got over 2,500 members already. But essentially, our mission is to professionalize patient engagement as a discipline in end-to-end medicines development. And that's including all the stakeholders that are part of it, not just industry through sponsors, but also solution providers, because a lot of what they're bringing, like Curtsy & Curtsy, is really innovative, but also patient advocacy groups and patient organizations. So all rolling up their sleeves to bring the patient perspective into drug development.
Right.
Before we go into your data, I'm just curious, can you tell me a little bit more about the sorts of folks who are members of ISPEP? Are they people like you and me? Alex and I used to work together a long time ago, or are they others?
Yeah, so it's a real mix end to end. So ISPEP, and it's spelled like, and it's pronounced like Pepsi backwards. Which always makes me smile, because I always used to say, whenever I did thought leadership before, that brands that do fizzy water actually sometimes spend more time on their consumers than we did in pharma. Sure. So it's quite ironic now that we've actually got the opposite, Pepsi into ISPEP. But yeah, so the kind of individuals that we have are, I would say, chief patient officers, global patient officers, patient advocacy leads, but also now we're seeing more and more of these roles evolving. What you and I used to do, Jane, in R&D. So these new frameworks are being created. So I would say end to end in industry. So both from a communication and advocacy later on down the line, but actually now looking at translation of patient experience and bringing the patient voice into R&D. But then also, like I said, leaders and patient advocacy groups, leaders or who represent patients and patient representatives as well, because these are professionals in their own right that work a lot with the pharmaceutical industry.
So, Alex, first of all, I'm glad you didn't reverse Coke. You chose Pepsi. That's great.
We didn't do it on purpose, by the way. That was after the fact, not
Yeah,
realization.
wouldn't sound the same. You mentioned about professionalizing kind of that way. Can you say a little bit more about that? Was it just because there was no organization? Do you feel that there was no standards, or what is it that you're professionalizing?
We actually identified that there was a gap in the focus of the who. So there's these wonderful organizations out there who focus on the what and the how, the UPATIs, the new organization PEPS. So there's lots who do actually really look at that standardization through the processes. But we really wanted to see and focus on the individuals, so professionalizing their role. I think we're seeing more people now not just falling into these roles, but actually evolving their career into this. So how do we ensure that there's standardization in how they're actually able to bring their skills and competencies and actually being able to share best practice across themselves to ensure that there's a consistency in the application of, I guess, bringing the patient voice in through the individuals.
And
So
I'm
like,
assuming, go
yeah.
ahead, sorry, go ahead.
So that said, we realized that the individuals themselves really needed some support and they needed to have a community where they can cross-pollinate, they can share, they can essentially look to bring an international mindset as well towards patient engagement, where historically there was a lot about US and outside EU5. We're now really bringing every single corner of the world into it to learn from each other.
I have a lot more questions for you, but it's just interesting about this whole concept. So I'm assuming there's a very diverse backgrounds of people maybe who are doing patient engagement, but is there any phenotype? Is it a lot of people who've had experience with the healthcare system and kind of driven them to do that? Or what are you seeing in terms of who actually is going into that field?
Yeah, so there are there's mixtures of that. There's definitely a lot of individuals who've worked out in I would say in the healthcare setting, lots of nurses, not for pro like public bodies as well, who've then moved across. So yeah, there's a mixture, but I would say most have kind of come in through a medical background, through the pharmaceutical background, that then had to evolve and change their skills into essentially what constitutes not just from a communication piece with patients, but I would say what's now changing is more around how do we translate into almost like a scientific translation of their needs into the needs of the pharmaceutical drug development needs.
And have you found that, I'm assuming that you've gone global, that maybe some countries aren't as mature in terms of developing those kind of roles, and are they different global differences you see?
Yeah, so we're just beginning to really delve into this. We've launched our regional ambassador program, and so the team have been kind of collating the information, and we're looking to really launch that into 2026 because we want to be learning as to what is happening in those emerging or developing markets. I am seeing that there's certainly, for instance, in Latin America, that voice of patients is really rising up. And we have ambassadors in Asia Pac. We have ambassadors in MENA who can begin to kind of demonstrate what constitutes the differences potentially with engagement with patient advocacy groups versus the much more, I would say, evolved, for instance, like the US space, where it's also a lot easier, I would say, to engage with patient advocacy groups.
Thank you. Sorry about a bunch of questions, but I thought it'd be great for the audience to know more about it. That's great.
I think they're great questions. Now I'm just going to do a shameless pitch
Yeah.
because what you're talking about is actually aligned to the keynote that I dropped on LinkedIn last night that I have the pleasure of hosting at Scope in February. But it's not about me. The opportunity is to actually have patients literally talk about their experience and maybe share some things they didn't quite expect about being in trials. So hold that. And I'm going to shift us over. Thank you, by the way. I really loved all that context of what ISPEP is and where and who. Now I want to hear more about the research that you have done together. And first, what prompted it? And then, second, how did you collect it? Then we're going to talk a little bit, like we're really just teasing people a little bit for your webinar coming up next week, right? So you can drop that in too.
Excellent. Thanks, Jane. In terms of how this research came to be, so at Curtsy & Curtsy, we're all about creating campaigns and crafting conversations and really inventing experiences that drive engagement for clinical trials and research programs. And we find that by listening and learning and sharing those insights, we really uncover what matters most to people. So it's kind of at the heart of everything we do. And with this project, what we found is that we had this unanswered question, that there were gaps in the experience data. There are other survey results that are being published. There are other pieces of research. But for us, what we were really missing was the patient and participant narrative, really understanding what drives that experience. So the research was founded into three sections, which is, how are people coming in, why are they staying, and what is causing them to not see it through to the very end. So the unanswered question we had was that as trials evolve and complexity in science and technology increases, then what do clinical trial participants in the modern day really want and need as they navigate this process? So that's where we set out to start our kind of research journey. And as Alex has just explained, everything that is value-led at ISPEP that sits within the ISPEP growth felt like an absolute meeting of minds and values and mission. So hence why we decided to collaborate on this project together.
And I think one of the things as well, when we first started talking about this, it was that real recognition about the rising complexity. So that's why there was a very kind of considered viewpoint to ensure that patients were only included in this that participate in the trial in the past 5 years. Obviously, Jane and Amir have been very involved with the DTRA, so knowing the challenges for the industry from that perspective, but also wanting to ensure we understood the challenges and the impact to patients, not obviously just from a DCT technology perspective, but just the added complexity of the trials and the volume of trials and the options potentially that are out there to be able to get a really clean cut of data in the more modern times. And I think the other thing we talked about, Stacey, as well, there's some amazing data out there, but there's a lot about the what. And one of the things we agreed on is we wanted to delve deeper into the why as well, which made this a much, much deeper engagement.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. You said you divided the research into three domains, and the first is really how do you get into a trial? I'm paraphrasing. And it looks like I read the report, and I believe Paige dropped that in the link here. Patients are finding trials not through their doctors so much. It's not exclusively other ways, but tell us a little bit about that and how it is similar or different to what you see in other surveys. But then let's talk about the why that matters for a minute.
Yeah, so in terms of the study really revealed that participants are finding trials through predominantly through social media and through online ads. So those independent searches rather than going through their clinicians, doctors, HCPs. So it's really kind of suggestive that currently clinical research is still really operating outside of those routine care pathways. And instead of being offered trials as part of a standard of care, people are really going forward and actively seeking clinical research opportunities themselves, which was, is fascinating. The really interesting part to add on to that, though, was we then explored within our questioning, once you've identified a clinical trial opportunity, where do you go for additional information? And that's the point that participants then go back to their doctors, clinicians, healthcare professionals and say, what do you think? Is this right for me? Can I have your advice? And that's a really high percentage. So we're in this situation here where people are kind of having to feel empowered, go out and find the opportunities themselves. But there's not enough information, education that would then enable them to move forward and actually start to apply for participation in clinical trials. At that point, they really want the clinical touch points. They want the support to say, yes, this feels right for you. So those two pieces of data together are quite compelling.
Yeah, one of the things that was quite surprising as well, though, wasn't it, Stacey, is that there were, I mean, where they're looking for, it's definitely needing the healthcare professional validation, kind of from a trust and comfort perspective. But they're also the pharmaceutical sponsor websites, that was one of the highest sources. The one thing that was quite surprising about, which I think we need to work harder on, is the actual with patient advocacy groups. That's one of the things that was quite surprising, that they weren't necessarily utilizing those resources as much as we were hoping to. And I don't know, Stacey, whether there was any kind of feedback as to the reason for that.
No, not necessarily within the patient advocacy groups. So these were findings predominantly from our survey respondents. When we complemented this with some qualitative research, we had 20 interviews with participants who had taken part in the clinical trial over the past 5 years. And at that point, what we were finding was more of the narrative was really around, I was expecting to hear of the opportunities from my clinician. But actually, I really had to be under the care of the right clinician, so somebody who was involved in the study. Or you had to kind of seek out that person yourself to be able to have a conversation. So it was very much around the clinician-led conversations. And we were kind of hearing from participants, one of the quotes was, unless you're seeing a specialist, you're not likely to be referred into this clinical trial.
So I'm going to say, even if you are, you're not. So, Amir, I'm going to ask you your thoughts on that, and maybe you have a follow-up question. As a clinician, is this something that surprises you? Is it unrealistic to think that they could do this? What do you think?
To refer or what exactly?
To know, to be able to navigate a patient through the idea, oh, I might want to be in a trial, even if they're not conducting the trial.
This is a very complex can of worms, right? So we could talk about it for an hour. I mean, I think there's so many factors. It's, whether it's your global region, whether it's your, the education of physicians, there's just so much there about why would a clinician have the knowledge or the motivation to really walk through a patient through those options. And I think those really vary. I think what would be a really interesting sort of complementary survey would be from, clinicians to see what their attitudes are towards research. And we know, I mean, there's a lot of work done on that, right? But I think probably the biggest elephant in the room, especially in the US, is around incentives. Yeah. So right now, frankly, in the US, many clinicians, there's a financial disincentive to refer to trials. Yeah. So one thing is knowledge, another one is, the incentives, and also within the healthcare system. So it's not even down to the individual clinician. Yeah. It's, what incentives there are for the health system. So I think all those things make it quite a complex sort of minefield to navigate, to understand it.
Yeah, and I think this is where certain healthcare systems and regulatory environments, like in the UK, I know that's been a very, very big driver. And I'm really excited to actually see the new updated guidelines that are going to be coming out in 6 months' time, really looking to to innovate in this space following their James O'Shaughnessy, Lord James O'Shaughnessy review. So they're actually looking to bring in the GP networks. There's already quite a few of them that are already involved in this, who are actively want to be there in the primary care setting, discussing clinical trials with their patients and the incentivization that would go with it as well.
Well, I think this is places where, you know, somewhere like the UK or Singapore or other places probably have an advantage of being able to lead here if possible, you know, having national systems. I think that's much more likely than this fragmented system like the US.
Oh, I'm going to wave my flag now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Just because I didn't mention Canada.
Small population.
Yeah.
Very wide distribution and a new law that allows doctors to practice across other provinces. So we'll just park that. Maybe we'll talk with some experts later.
Jenny, I was going to say into this as well, just my comment about the patient advocacy groups. I think one thing that I'm really excited about, and this research has shown, is the fact that I think it demonstrates that long-term relationships need to be created with patient advocacy groups and patient organizations, rather than at the end kind of more transactional, which will then enable that kind of like stronger, earlier enablement to help support this paradigm.
I'm going to go back to Amir's word though. Incentives are a big deal. And actually, as a rare patient myself, the advocacy group is deeply fragmented in that there are lots of options. So consolidating the information and making decisions is a little tricky. Yeah. I'm going to shift us into that middle section now. Like we talked about finding, how about when you get into a trial? So you were asking participants themselves who had been in a trial in the last 5 years. And I'm really curious, what did they tell you that a good clinical trial experience is like or not like?
Yeah, so before we kind of go into that clinical trial experience, you know, unsurprisingly, no big shocker here, but what we did find was the better that clinical trial experience or perception of that experience, then the greater the likelihood of trial completion was. So like I say, no big shocker, but also it then starts to kind of just build those layers that we start to see. So the single greatest indicator within our research of trial completion or trial experience was the perceived support from site teams. So either the support or the connection or the relationship, the communication, all the various components that sit around that. But it was very much around how much support was felt that the site team that you were seeing at each of your appointments was providing was directly linked to that trial experience.
I got a follow-up question. Does that include reimbursement and paying the patient for their time or participation?
There were some patients who would have been reimbursed for their time. This was a global study, so we had representation globally. So that wasn't the case fully across the board, but would have been in some instances.
It's just, there's a lot of misconceptions about that too. So we'll just park that and move on. Is there anything that came up that patients told you made it a not so great experience?
Yeah, do you know, it's quite a broad term, but one of the key things that participants said was disorganization. So going into a site and feeling like the people they were dealing with within site were disorganized. It didn't make them feel comfortable. It didn't eradicate any anxiety. It felt like it was just chaotic. And the second that started to creep in, we were told by participants, there was a big kind of erosion of trust, a big erosion of that feeling like I've got you. And that directly impacted into the experience scores.
So Stacey,
I'm going to giggle. It sounds like a Four Seasons experience versus an a Marriott experience.
Don't get me started on hospitality and travel. I have a million questions. I'll start. I think, okay, let's summarize what you said, Stacey, that we believe that patient experience is directly correlated to the completion of the study, right? And that you are saying that the biggest driver of a good experience is site support. Was there any other factors that you feel are really critical for a good experience? Was there anything else you found out apart from general site support?
Yeah, so the other element, so it was kind of linked to that site support, but the other element that is related that we go forward through into the next pillar of findings was the caregiver support as well. So what we found was within participants who needed a caregiver to support them through their experience and their process, when the caregiver was really included within all of their conversations, within their decision making, was equally as educated and aware as the participant, that was a big driver for success going forward. So again, it's sort of connected in that it's that kind of communication, relationship, etc., but actually thinking beyond just the participant.
Okay, so let me take the example that Jane gave about Four Seasons versus a Marriott. You know, both Jane and I just came from two meetings, right? You know, Siena Summit in DTRA, and my inbox is full of hundreds of people telling my team how Summit is the best run meeting they've ever been to, right? It's a bit like a Four Seasons versus a Marriott, right? But here's the issue, which I find fascinating. Think about a site. What you're really doing when you go to a site as a patient, you're going to a building that at the same time, possibly maybe in most cases, not a Four Seasons, but let's just pretend some trials are like that. But they're running a Four Seasons and a Hilton and a Marriott and a Hampton Inn in the same building, actually, and being paid different rates by those brands to see these patients. And if you're an academic site, it's not even your day job. So actually, you can imagine the analogy I'm making up as we go along right now live is that, you know, I don't know, you're running a kitchen where, you know, your main job is running a hotel, and then you've got different sponsors, you know, different. So that's the site experience, right? How on earth you're supposed to deliver a consistent experience when you're doing that, running 20 studies while you're doing your academic job is kind of interesting, first of all. The other problem we have, which I think is the elephant in the room, is certainly in the US where I live at the moment, well, when I'm not traveling, the healthcare experience is horrible, right? Doesn't matter what your insurance is, doesn't matter who you know. And it's nothing to do actually with the clinicians. The clinicians are really doing their best in most cases. It's the system that's really preventing them from giving good care. So I think most people I know who have any contact with the healthcare system at the moment really have a bad experience. It's very rare. You might hear they say, oh, the doctor was very nice or the nurse was very nice, but that's about it. The rest of the experience. So the healthcare system as a whole does a terrible job. Okay, but hold on. In clinical research, we're not providing patient care, right? It is a science project. So many people forget that. There's a lot of people on LinkedIn still who kind of just don't understand that the people who come into trials are not there for, as a pure researcher would think of as getting care. They're in a science experiment, okay? Then the big elephant in the room also is the fact that you talk about patient experience. Than how making it better is a good thing, right? Let me tell you, there's lots of researchers will bring you the P word out, the really big P word out, which is placebo response. They absolutely are worried that anything you do to be nice to patients, to improve their experience, will kill the study because placebo rates will go up. So they're really worried about that. So, how do you improve the experience when actually many people think improving the experience will kill your study, right? I'll finish my rant in a minute. So, you know, many PIs will tell you how they train their staff, that they need to be somehow supportive, but don't tell someone they've got nice hair today. Because if that's the patient in depression trial, they may actually report their symptoms differently than if the receptionist wasn't nice to them. So I'll stop there, but as we can see, that's a hell of a lot of complexion going on there that we have to think about, right?
I think there's a lot of onus that we're putting here onto the sites. That's the thing. And the thing is, site experience, good site experience equals good patient experience. This is something that's really come through in the research. And I think, yes, there's a huge amount of variability in the sites, of course. We saw that in the research. I recently kind of experienced that through patient counsel around having patients with the same condition talking about wildly different experiences depending where they went. But I think there is an element of accountability potentially from the global teams that we need to try and centralize and kind of take that onus off the sites in more ways, whether that's removing the complexity. We all know about the technologies, everybody very, very, varying the same thing, but applying the different variables onto the sites. So I think there is something there that we can look to potentially centralize and streamline even more so for the sites. I mean, Stacey, you and I talked about the AI piece that came through quite a lot in the research as well. So whether there's kind of like a more quicker mechanisms that we can kind of utilize with our sites so they can help to improve the communication, for instance, with the patients, not just, of course, streamline the processes. That was one piece that came out of the research, I think. But I think there's definitely things there that if we streamline and simplify more, take more accountability centrally onto the sites, that will then improve the experience irrespective of the placement for the patients.
Right, Alex, I completely agree what you're saying around, you know, can we support sites to be not as chaotic as Stacey described it, right? To all that. I think that's great. I'm just painting the picture of this is the context we're in, right? It's a really challenging context. Yeah. We can't get it right in healthcare, let alone clinical research. Yeah. But I really take your point that, you know, what can sponsors do more to improve this site experience to then improve this, you know, the patient subject experience,
And I think we have to acknowledge, and we did this through some industry validation as well to get industry perspectives. We have to acknowledge, as you say there, there is so much that is being handled by a site. Your analogy was absolutely spot on. So we are giving them all the means by which to juggle 1,000 balls, and they are doing it. So absolutely, if there is chaos, it's completely founded. We understand why. And what we started to try to explore with industry was, as Alex says, what are the ways in which we can start to streamline certain things in order to essentially be able to open up space and time and resource to be able to have the human connection conversations. So actually, is there parts of this that we can take away using AI mechanisms, using other operational efficiencies that enable site staff to bring empathy, connection, the things that the robots can't do, essentially? How do we give extra time?
Oh, wait now. Some of my robots are actually better at this than my humans. Just
but you know,
you know something? I mean, what we're talking about here is, like I said, not just site-centric classical. I mean, this also extended out to when we were talking to the more hybrid clinical trials. So it's more around that the concentricity around the sites, the utilization of kind of the telemedicine, the kind of like remote kind of solutions, that's still extended out. So how do we bring the structure and the consistency for patients, even when it's not directly related to being within a site, on hospital, being in the craziness? And that's one of the things that came through as well in the research. So it's structure, organization, and routine that really, really helped enable the patients to have a much better experience in their trials.
Kind of like I would like to reorder the same thing every 3 months in my Amazon account. I'm totally making that up, but it's another, okay, I'm going to park that.
A subscription.
I kind of want to flip the page a little and ask, how many patients and caregivers are being asked what their experience is like? And then how is that information actually translating into action on the part of those who can make a difference either at the site or the sponsor?
So I think what we can answer that with is anecdotal evidence at the moment, and we can kind of give some opinion on that. We don't have that data within the stats per se, but I think in terms of that experience data from anecdotal evidence, we're hearing that there is a time delay with that being able to be led back to sponsor level where change can be elicited. So there's clearly some sort of breakdowns at various places. And I guess as we move forward and we understand this, one of the things that came up through the sort of myriad of conversations with participants, with industry, is whether or not the future could hold the potential to have some sort of personalized approach here. So a clinical trial experience is a little bit personalized, not individualized, but just personalized. So we understand preferences. We understand how people want to be communicated with, how they want to engage with technology. Do they want a phone call on a Tuesday at 11 a.m., or would they rather have a text message as and when? Those sort of elements that we have within our worlds all the time, because that's how we engage with all of the other platforms that make up our lives currently. Is there potential to move towards that kind of arena? And therefore, that feedback loop that we started with here, Jane, is then preemptively considered as well.
Basically, that makes a lot of sense, that personalization, technology can help us with that. It certainly makes a lot of sense for engagement and retention, right, for sure. And I think it's very possible. It's not something we do now at all, is it, really?
Yeah.
We at DTR talk about all the time about optionality. You know, some patients, because of travel, can't make it to a site. Other ones would like to be at the site. It's not one way or the other. I think what ideally we want to do is give that choice of a personal level to each participant, right?
But you know something, Amir, sometimes actually it's that would obviously be the perfect thing. But I think it's also more about how we convey the information to patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk to them from a very operational perspective. This is, you know, your schedule, the schedule of assessments, essentially what that's going to look like, how often we expect you to come to the visit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like our translation of our protocol onto them. This is how we talk to them. That's our patient materials. I think there's also an element, and this probably goes back to the staff, site staff again, is translating that into their lived experience, is to be able to actually understand in more detail the emotional burden that occurs to them. It's almost like, how can we talk to them in the language that they will understand to then be able to truly match their daily experience into the expectations of the trial? So I think there's an element of personalization in how we convey that information to them as well, that will then be able to be matched onto their personal experience. Because of course, as we know, to go have a disease, a condition, it's so burdensome as it is. And then the clinical trials on top of that, I think sometimes patients don't actually even realize when they're going into the clinical trial, the duplicate, triplicate burden that falls onto them without truly understanding the impact. And that was something that was coming through quite loud and clear as well.
Well, sure, when the pressure is to recruit, I'm sure the pressure is also not maybe communicate all the, you know, things patients need to do. Suddenly, every time I have to take someone to ER or go to the hospital, I'm amazed how badly we communicate to patients. I would have, if I was the attending, I would have sacked most of the residents and fellows I come across. They use big words all the time. They really communicate in a way that's not understandable to patients, especially when the rates of functional illiteracy is pretty high.
I know that the kind of speaking to patients in various councils, the one thing that they really thought was a very positive thing, but it doesn't happen too often, is like patient navigators that literally can be holding their hand at the site. Yes. They're HCPs, they're not the nurses, but they can take through the experience, and that conduit between the site staff and the patients. Again, I think that's that emotional bond. I say that in inverted commas, but emotional bond. That can really take them through that journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Kind of very curious to know if maybe the bots could take some of that role, but again, that's Maybe you have thoughts on that, Dr. Kalali.
Well, it'd be robots with AI that can actually literally hold your hand and walk you between the rooms without falling on their faces, yeah, like the Russian one.
Or it could be an avatar that works with me.
But you know something, patients probably wake up in the middle of the night worried, you know, they've got things in their mind, so they can actually quickly engage with something that gives them an answer. You can
Sure.
actually begin to track, you know, the areas of stress and the times that they're stressed, etc. So I think there is a value to those, that's for sure, especially as we're moving into things like conversational AI, that makes it a lot more personal.
As long as they're accurate, yeah.
Of course.
Well, and I do hear
there's no bias,
exactly what you were citing. Like there is some concern that that different level or additional level of support actually influences treatment outcomes and might change the signal you're capturing in your data. So I don't know about that. We'll have to. It's interesting. I do want to encourage if anyone has a question to either put it in the chat. I don't see anything, or raise your hand because you got experts here. You might as well have the opportunity to ask what's on your mind. So, okay, we're not necessarily asking the patients and the caregivers, and the caregiver experience influences the patient experience and participation. What about this emotional readiness question? What do you think we need to think about there?
I think this is a really key part of the entire process within clinical research recruitment and retention. As we just touched upon there, a lot of the time we talk through the protocol, we explain what the protocol is going to include, we talk about the sort of the logistics, we talk about the expectations in terms of number of visits and how long it's going to go on for and what your long-term follow-up might look like. But what we don't do necessarily is kind of contextualize it and talk about the emotional journey that being on a clinical trial for a lot of people will involve. So I think there is there's a real piece here around that empathetic conversation that can be had to really kind of understand fully, meet people where they're at. Everybody's lives are different. They're all at different stages of life. They have different pulls on their time. They have different responsibilities. And actually being able to empower people to make conversations about whether they want to move forward with clinical research by having all of the information, being aware of the entire picture, I think is really key. I think we sort of owe it to people to really be able to explain that in ways that are not so much around you will have 10 visits over the next 15 months, but it's actually like, what does that involve? What does that include? What will you also be signing up for?
Yeah. And I think this then, Jane, can also be taken much earlier into the design of the protocols. I think we're getting better as an industry, bringing the patient voice into the patient councils, you know, kind of looking to bring the thoughts around what really is a, in inverted commas, patient-ready protocol. But I think there's still a big factor around validating of what we want to hear. So it's still bringing them to say, yay, nay, of kind of a schedule of assessments, does this, could this work with you, etc. I think there's a real miss sometimes in opening up the conversation to patients so that you really do hear the hidden truths, so that you really understand the true intensity of what they're going for, rather than a binary validation of what you want to hear. I think there's, as an example, for instance, that was really interesting in the recent council was Alzheimer's. And patients, one thing that came through from it is I didn't realize that all the patients that were talking about this, they said that noise, for instance, is a big factor to concentration. And especially if they were in a busy hospital, like we talked about earlier, versus a, you know, contained research research site, noise really, really was not able to help them to focus. It really took them away from what they were doing, and it really increased their anxiety. So we actually even talked about how can we provide upfront, as part of actually a study technology, earphones for them across the board. I know it's something that's tiny, but it was something that had a huge impact on the potential protocol and the compliance and the result and the actual delivery of results, for instance, on the quality of life and PROs. So that's just one example. But it's like if we were to go and redesign how we write protocols, I think we had one example recently, didn't we, from Scope, that essentially where instead of kind of taking a protocol that's already created, and often they're the same that we get copy and paste. I'm sure it doesn't happen anymore, but instead doing almost like a design thinking kind of a mentality where you start with empathy and you actually then build the protocol and build the actual full clinical trial experience from the ground up for with the really understanding the full end-to-end requirements of patients.
James, you
Alex,
mean clinical? You mean the stuff we were doing 12 years ago,
yes,
Alex?
that always happens, a sine wave, and this is what happens. I know. But like I said, there's just so much validation that happens. This is what you want. So, of course, you're going to hear often what you expect to hear.
So,
Camille, yeah.
yeah, so the concept of emotional readiness and all that is really interesting. I think here's the challenge. You describe talking to the patient, right? And asking about kind of some hidden stuff. Well, it's like, who's paying for that right now? Nobody, right? So to me, a good PI, the reason they get paid is actually ultimately deciding whether a patient is appropriate for that protocol. You could frankly meet every criteria to get into that protocol, but for various reasons should not be put into that protocol. I'm not sure how often that happens anymore, right? Because they just want to hit those recruitment numbers. So you would think, as a sponsor, it will be absolutely worth the investment to have pay for the time it takes to really be careful about getting patients that are not going to drop, right? Because I think even most investigators, frankly, underestimate the importance of retention in terms of a statistical and study success. In fact, I think, Jen, I think we're in the session I was in at Summit where this CEO of a company had to literally, basically, the company nearly died because they were missing so much data within one program that to rerun the whole thing and raise money to do it. If only they had a few more patients be retained, they could have actually got the approval with, the study they had. So I think this is a critical thing, but I don't think anyone's really paying attention to the quality of the patient coming in terms of retention and their experience, right?
Exactly that, and thinking about the longevity of the engagement going forward as well. I think from our experience, we don't. I think there needs to be some activity around that engagement at the same time. So it's really kind of profiling the participant at the very beginning and setting them up for success, setting yourself up for success.
Right.
But also understanding through those conversations and through that early profiling, what are the engagement risks here and what do we need to do over the course of this study to maintain engagement and how do we understand when that might be waxing and waning?
So you used the word long term, I think, just then, right? Nothing we do in terms of patient engagement is long term. We're extremely transactional. Extremely. So sadly, Marriott does a better job at having membership and people go and stay at Marriott because they have to get their points, right? We are so transactional compared to even consumer brands like that, right?
No, I agree. I agree. I was just going to say, I think one of the things that just very quickly, just before we go into that, Mia, I think one of the things I do just want to raise that's this is a bone of contention between everybody, but I'm hearing it lots from the engagements that we've had with patients, and I think also from the discussions that we had with Cutsy and the BioPharm sponsors. The ICFs is probably the one area that really is causing the continuum. Either the preventing of patients going in or patients going in without the full understanding of what they're going into. And I think that's a call to action. I know it's a yearly one. I know we're talking about it continuous for years and years and years, but that's one thing that always comes up as a real challenge with regards to being a bottleneck. And with regards to the engagement, I think one of the things that was coming through, Stacey, is both the continuum of engaging with patients. They need to have the connection, whether that's a decentralized trial or actually an on-site trial is the ability to have to be able to have the questions, to be able to have the phone calls, to be able to essentially be able to ask the questions that they need, to be able to then know what's going to be happening the next day when they're going into a site. And one thing is about doing with really great materials, but another thing is that human connection that continuously came through. And I think, Stacey, I'll let you give the data from the results, but it's to your point, Amir, as well, what happens at the end? Is that continuum at the end? It's almost like the fall off a cliff. And so many patients still don't get the information after what happened to the trial after committing so many of their years into this as well. Stacey, did you want to give some of those findings that we found?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we asked the question, what happens at the end of the trial? What does that communication look like? And what we found was that 1 in 3 had nothing at all. Nothing at all. So we'd have their last visit and that was sort of, job done. And the interesting element to that as well was that actually there was a really big percentage, I think it was about two-thirds, maybe just over two-thirds of people wanted information. They were actually looking for their own results. If not just the trial summary, then or the trial results summary. And I think only about a third did receive a trial results summary anyhow. The interesting thing here, though, is that most participants wanted to see that information. There's a real validation in knowing that I have given my data, my participation in this research has meant something. We did a lot of work. There's a few questions and we've analysed it around individual motivations for partaking in clinical trials. And as you can imagine, there's a myriad of reasons, lots of diversity in that. But actually, to loop it back around, people want to know what the outcome was of the trial. What did their involvement mean? So there's so many loops there that kind of need pulling and connecting back together. And simple things, thank you cards, thank you for your participation. Even if we can't go down as far as these are your results, this is what, this is what we've taken and how you individually have contributed to the outcome. Anything at all, just to kind of finish off that interaction people were really seeking.
I think one of the other things as well just suddenly made me think about this, because I know we're coming up to the end, but I know it's so important, both from the research and from the discussions actually with biopharma, is that patients are very invested and they simply need to understand. There's a few things that we talked about from the biopharma discussions where there was nervousness about, patients may not understand or for instance, it may be too complex for them. But one of the things that when we pressure tested them, patients' kind of commitment and therefore better attention increased when they simply understood and the why behind it. So not necessarily even if it was something that, for instance, I think it was the discussion about giving the study results, for instance.
Yes.
So, in certain given time, a lot of the time we simply don't. And in actual fact, if we explained why not, talked about, for instance, the challenges, regulatory timelines, commercial, etc., then patients would understand, but it's just being told and respected to be told so that they can actually just go, okay, now I understand. And that was a really interesting factor that came through as well.
So what you're saying is don't treat them like it's a black box.
Exactly. Just simply explain. And even if it's not what they want to hear, and as long as they understand why, there was a very, very positive, positive kind of outcome from it.
Well, we have a psychiatrist in the room, but I'm not going to let him delve there. It seems like basic human behavior, and we're not really executing to that standard.
And it's not humanizing the experience, yes.
Well, I know we have only 3 minutes, so before we lose you, when is the webinar? How would people sign up?
Yes, so the webinar is next Wednesday the 19th at 2 p.m. UK time, so 9 a.m. EST, ET. And it will be through the ISPEP environment. So what we can do is we can share the LinkedIn post afterwards, but also have a look at our LinkedIn as well. Hopefully people get lots and lots of really good information about what's happening globally in the world of patient engagement. Stacey, I believe it will be posted on the Cutsy & Cutsy LinkedIn as well.
It will do indeed. And also, just to say, for anybody who's listening who hasn't had a chance to download and read the report, then we'll also provide the link for you to do so.
That'd be brilliant. And then just to let you know, obviously this is a very open, kind of active discussion, but at the webinar, we will be spending time to go into more detail with the slides showcasing the data, to actually be able to see more the stats and the reasoning and the quotes, etc.
Yeah, so you're actually going to show charts and pictures and graphs, and we didn't let you do that today. Thanks for playing along with the audio only format.
Brilliant, Jane. Thank you. It's
Any
been
last words from you, Dr. K?
Well, thank you very much, Alex and Stacey. You're doing important work, and we have a long way to go. We're at the beginning of it. So, really appreciate everything you're doing.
Thank you, Amir.
Thank
I
you.
love it too. And I second the effort and the intention. And I'll leave you with a thought that has been in my head a lot this year. It's conflicting, but hope is actually an agent of misinformation. And that's something that I think we could dive into in another conversation.
I look forward to hearing that conversation, Jane.
Very much.
Thank you so much for your time, your expertise, for the work you're doing, and for the open invite to everyone to join the webinar next week. I'm delighted that we were able to get some people curious.
And
You're
thank you
very
for the invitation for being here today. It's been wonderful.
It has been. Thank you.
Take care,
All
guys.
right. Happy
Thanks.
weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.